We're back with another episode of Gab and Jules Meets. Now, this is a show where Jules and I have conversations with people who we think are interesting, right, Jules?
Yeah.
In the world of football.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Different profiles. We've had former players, current players.
Not just former players. We had Zlatan. Both a former player and a current player, some might say. But, this time we've got something who's a bit different because this is somebody who did not play professional football. And this is somebody who was in the right place at the right time, carpe diem'd the situation.
Yes, exactly.
And became a super influential person running football operations.
Hey, I'm Mike Ford. I come from working 25 years in this professional sports industry spanning US and European sports.
All right, Mike, I'm gonna kick you off just with your story because you were not. I'm sure you were a fine footballer in your youth, but you were never a professional footballer. And yet you got to work, but you started in professional football and then moved out across other sports as well. I think a lot of people who know they're not going to be pursuing that professional sports career would love to have a gig like the ones you've had or the ones you have now. So, could you tell us a little bit about your story? Because I'm assuming a lot of it often has to do with being in the right place at the right time, as well as being good at what you do.
Yeah, no, listen, I would always put a tremendous amount of credit to the people that give you a chance at any sort of career. So you're right, Gabs. I was probably one of the first of a generation that came into professional football that wasn't an ex-player and came into what we'd call a front office and that. So I trained as a sports scientist, moved into trained as a sports psychologist, and I got introduced via a company I was working with to Bolton. And Sam Allardyce had just taken the job. This is the late 90s, the job at Bolton. And probably one of the first conversations I had with him, and again, I was only in my early 20s himself, he said, listen, I'm not sure of the value of this, but he said, I spent a year at Tampa Bay and Rowdies, and he said, you know, we used to go to the party of the sports psychologist all the time, and we all kind of bought into what he was doing because he had this amazing house on the ocean and he held his biggest party. So he said, I'm not expecting you to have an amazing house on the ocean, but I'm going to give you a shout. And so Sam was a great sponsor. This is, again, late 90s. And at the time, it was one of them perfect storms, Gabs. You know, the Premier League was probably 6 or 7 years old in its fall after David Dean and that group had the vision to transform it from what it was. And it was one of them perfect things, totally out of your control. You know, the right club at the right time, looking for a competitive advantage with the right ownership. The late Phil Gartside, who deserves a tremendous amount of credit too, was the chairman at the time. And I was there just at the right time. You know, it was one of the things, we were in the championship. There was it's trendy now to talk about marginal gains, right? But back in the day, it was like, how do we do things different? And Sam had the vision and the foresight to drive that. And, you know, I was fortunate at the time to be one of a select group of staff with a particular focus to help him achieve that. So that was my entry point.
Because we see Sam now a bit as a dinosaur, right? And probably the wrong image. But back then, he was quite innovative.
He was very, I think, he was very innovative at the time. If you go back to what was the state of the nation, I read some stat that the first day of the Premier League in its current format, which was maybe 91, 92, I think there was 11 foreign players. And Sam was, you know, built a squad, a roster, where he embraced the players who were on the edges. So I go back to some of the first players we had the fortune to sign. Yuri Djorkaeff won the World Cup with France in 98, been cast aside at Kaiserslautern, was training on his own. Sam had the foresight to bring him in January 2002. I remember he was flying to Germany to sort of convince him to come. He was 6% body fat. Everyone said, don't touch him. This guy's a nightmare. This guy's a mess. And he was transformational. And Sam had several of them players through his career, Fernando Hierro, JJ Okocha, and that. And his sort of raison d'etre at the time was, how do we get the marginal gains out of these players? Everyone has cast them aside. How do we get them physically, mentally, emotionally back on track? And that return and that culture that was created as a function of that allowed him to do. So was it anything that was innovative? Probably not. But the aggregation of all of them practices, Jules, was the thing that made him innovative.
Yeah. Really
and you were attracting all these guys who were big stars, presumably were financially well off. You're attracting them, when I say this with the greatest respect, to Bolton. I mean, I remember at the time people talked about the lure of London and players wanting to come to Chelsea and Arsenal. And okay, if you play for Liverpool or United, those are massive historic clubs. Bolton is none of that. It's basically suburban Manchester.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, they didn't have the pull of the Chelsea with, you know, what it was the late and great Gianluca Vialli going there in the late 90s with Ruud Gullit, etc. There was none of that Deschamps going there. There was no aura of association of playing in the marketplace. But what was part of the competitive advantage was how do we create an environment where players who had maybe been mistreated, you know, gone off on their own in a different direction, and how do we create a home for them? And allow them to feel special. So the environment, the physical environment, might not be the place, but the culture was something that we focused on a daily basis. And you know, one of them businesses where when you don't have a dollar, a euro, a pound, you have to spend every dollar twice. You start getting creative about how you get competitive advantage.
When you start as a sports psychologist at Bolton, at some point, was the ambition to go and get to a top club and run it? Or did you, as you were learning the trade, as you were learning more and more about how football clubs work, football teams, managers, players, agent, all of that, did you think, do you know what, I could do this because I'm smart enough, I've got good social skills, I've got this, I've got that? Or did it almost fall upon you a little bit at some point?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not smart enough, so we see the market sure for talent, and I won the race. But I would say, you know, probably for the first 10 years of my career, and you asked about career, I was telling my parents every 6 months I'm going to get a real job. There was no proxies in the market, guys. You know, there was no general manager, sporting directors. It was a head coach. You know, when I first started out, it was like the CEO, maybe the head coach or the manager, obviously in English football. And the chairman would have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea on a Friday at 3 o'clock and do all business then, right? So there was no systems, processes, structures, scenario planning. There was none of that, right? And then what happened, I think, you know, with the B Sky B, with the change of the Premier League, it allowed people like me who were naturally would never have got an opportunity or to interfere with the process, right? So when you start growing the business and the market became different, you know, for the portability of talent between players, between different leagues coming into the Premier League was growing in its financial strength, coaches coming up. Now the jigsaw is getting a bit more complicated, but at the heart of it is still about a head coach and a manager and a group of players. But you know, I came in as part of the first group of ologists, you know, psychologists, physiologists, etc., and that were trying to drive better performance out of these assets and that really. So I always built my career around, you know, stay curious and be a problem solver. And if you meditate on those two things, I think opportunity will find you. If you're in pursuit, and I was never in pursuit of a job title, I was in pursuit of an experience. And I was fortunate over them 15 years, whether it was the growth of the Bolton story, whether it was the growth, stabilization, internationalization of Chelsea as a brand in the early first 10 years of Mr. Abramovich's tenure and Chelsea's growth. They were all about problem solving. And if you were curious to solve problems and you had an open mindset and a learning mindset, you went out and found it. And I'll give you a quick story. I remember we were looking at player acquisition and analytics was starting to come into place. Maybe this is 2004, guys, 2005. And I remember finishing the season at Bolton. And the next morning, I got on a flight to the US and I visited 10 teams in 14 days. Straight out of my own pocket, flying economy, knocking on doors, just like I'm here to learn. And I met some incredible people that went on to change US sport. But it starts from that mindset of we are in an industry that's growing and I've got to be here to solve problems that are of no value. And I still think that whether it's a 23-year-old trying to break into the industry now, Gab, as you mentioned to me before, or someone who's trying to grow, if you're a problem solver, you're curious, you bring in a learning mindset, there'll always be a home for you. Because this is a dynamic industry that we choose to work in, and football is one of the most dynamic.
So you go from there, you move on to a completely different scenario because Roman Abramovich is not Phil Gartside, Chelsea's not Bolton, the scenario is different. You weren't looking for you know, Moneyball cast-off players who might make it big, you're looking to, you know, still looking for value, of course, you'll tell me, but you're looking to take Chelsea to the next level.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, we built on that every dollar, spend every dollar twice type model, Gabs, but I still think if you go back to that era, and I'll use the proxy of Billy Beam, I was with Billy Beam in maybe 2005. True story, and I'm with him for a couple of days. Fantastic guy. It was transformational in what he did with Moneyball and obviously Michael Lewis's story around it. And I'm leaving the stadium after spending 2 days, and I said, listen, full disclosure, I feel bad about this, but I need to tell you, I'm flying to see the Red Sox now. And I've got an introduction. I'm going to spend a couple of days with them. I feel like I need to tell you that because we've spent two good days. They said, no, the Red Sox guys, and it was Theo Epstein who was running the team at the time, with Jed Hoyer, who's now the Cubs president of baseball. They said, Mike, they're brilliant, those guys. He said, they're the worst evil. And I was like, what do you mean the worst evil? He said, they've got money and intelligence. Here we're trying to just work with intelligence, right? But we haven't got money. And I never forget, I got on the flight and I flew over to see them. And I actually, 2 days of them, and I told Jed, who's still a very good friend of mine, and he started laughing and that. And it was that sentiment when I had the privilege of getting to Chelsea, met Roman Abramovich, got offered an opportunity to be part of that very talented management team with Jose Mourinho was there the first time, Peter Kenyon and Frank Arneson. It was a very talented group. So a young guy in his early 30s, late 20s, early 30s, it was a wonderful opportunity to learn. And I carried that sentiment. How do we keep this sort of spend every dollar twice, marginal games, whatever the terminology is, and apply it where there's opportunity to grow? And I think that was when I met actually Roman for the first time. We talked in great detail about how do we live with this opportunity of growth, but also still apply some of these principles. It's very hard when you're racing to win all the time, to stay true to your principles. But that was the sentiment of my engagement and my entry point into Chelsea.
That's kind of the remarkable thing about it, which I think viewed from the outside, we don't always understand, is so you arrive there in 2006. Chelsea would go on to have, you know, an all-star cast of managers from, you mentioned Mourinho, but obviously Scolari, Carlo Ancelotti a few years later, you know, others after you moved on. And people often mock the fact that, oh, look, they only last a couple years, trigger happy Abramovich, player revolt, blah, blah, blah. But the team kept winning throughout that. And in my mind, I'm not saying coaches and managers aren't vitally important, but it also struck me as if they keep changing this, maybe the stability of the coach is not as important as the stability of the club, of the culture around it, of the systems that are in place.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You know, I remember one of the first times I was with Sam talking about squads, and he's like, you know, you want to be a good coach, get good players. You want to be a great coach, get great players. And I never really understood it until you went through it. And I, the first part of my time inside teams, I had one coach for 7 years, and I had nine coaches in 7 years in the second half of it. So you really get to see, okay, you know, what is the impact on the coach on success? And there's no doubt there is a part of it, but it's the right coach at the right time. I think that's why when I look back and, in our day-to-day business now, and you know, driven by some very talented business people inside Sportsology Group, you start to really understand, like, there's many ways to thread the needle, Gabs, in terms of success. And we were brought up with a understanding of these poster childs of, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson or a Belichick or a Joe Torre, depending on what story is. But now the world has changed, where with the influence of fans even more, the media, etc., that time to success is concertinaed in a negative way, in my view, that the time to deliver has gone down. So the paradigm shifted during my time, and I think you're right, it was cast aside because, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson didn't retire until he was 2013. So you'd see this North Star of stability, Arsene Wenger, this North Star of stability, and all the time you were changing. I still go back to, it's all about the players at the end of the day. You know, during that time, we had probably 10 of the best players in the world in their position. I remember an agent coming to see me one day and asked about a young player. Why wasn't he breaking into the team? He's the best under 19 in this position in Europe. He's been voted this. And I was like, because in his position is Frank Lampard. And he's the best guy in the world in that position of any age, right? So you go back to, you know, if you land the plane on a successful squad design, roster build, maintenance, squad management, etc., the coach is important, but it's less important. I think when you're in a turnaround project and you need to change the identity of the team, like what Manchester United have gone through in the last 12 months, I think the coach plays an over-indexed, in a positive way, impact on the culture.
But for example, when you're in charge like you were at Chelsea, and then the decision is made that the manager has to move, there must be times or managers with whom you felt closer maybe to others. And is that difficult to see him go, even if he had to go, for example? And what's your mindset when then someone else comes in the door and you obviously have to learn again to work with him, learn again about what he likes, doesn't like, etc. And then you have to do it again once he goes. What kind of mindset is that when you're running a football club as big as Chelsea Football Club?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. There's a very popular historical quote that goes, you know, the owner doesn't fire the coach, the players do. The owner just tells him he's leaving. And I think, you know, a lot of the time, the owners get press that they jumped in too quickly or they're trigger happy or not. But often, like ultimately, you know, if you look at a football team in Europe, for the sake of this discussion, 85% of the revenue is spent on 2.5% of the workforce, right, which is the players. Yeah. So those players have an over-indexed impact on outcome on so many different levels. So they are your ultimate net promoter of whether the project is working or not, or the team is working or the roster is working. And the key is like how do you manage that 360 dialogue with the players in this case and then decide upon when is the right time to either double down on a coach or to move past it. And I would say, you know, it's more art than science, guys. But invariably, when I look back at that era, there was probably one or two coaches that we let go too quickly. There was one or two that we let at the right time, the end of their project. And there was one or two that stayed the perfect amount of time.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Jules, what I find fascinating here is that you're director of football operations at Chelsea between 2006 and 2012, right? Yeah. Which is kind of like that
long time
heyday, right? It's a long time. This is the period they reach a Champions League final. They win. It's the end of the Mourinho era. They win a title with Carlo Ancelotti. They win European silver. And you always talk here about the importance of stability and all this stuff. I'm just curious, how does he actually feel about the ones who were sacked? Because there was a huge turnover of coaches. And maybe the ones who maybe should have stuck around longer.
Yeah, and also, as we know, Chelsea maybe had a different approach. Certainly Roman Abramovich at the time to what other clubs would have done. So it was really interesting. And I think that led us to ask him, like, what was the best thing and what was the worst thing in being in charge of managing a club like Chelsea?
You know, managing expectations as you go through that growth journey, I think, is a really important thing. So there was existential moments where, you know, a coach walks out of the building and you think, wow, we could have got another year out of this person, and I won't go into which ones. And then you look at the stability of other organisations and you go, like, wow, some days I wish we were like them. All right. But then your learning comes from the moments of growth. So when a new coach or a new management team comes in, you are constantly trying to find new ways of working. So no major problems. I think managing expectations particularly from a dynamic owner who wants to win everything. And you know, I always sort of reference this. I remember when Chelsea won the Champions League and in Munich for the first time, and I'm coming down into the dressing room, and behind there's only one person behind me, it's Didier Drogba with the trophy, right? So he walks in and he puts the trophy down in the middle of the table, and everyone's singing and dancing, and you know, there's laughing, maybe, you know, 25 players and 15 staff. It's one of them special moments that you look back even now. Well, these are moments in your life, and that anyway, in the situation, one of the staff, senior staff, says to the owner, "You need to say something. You need to say something." And so anyway, he speaks up the owner and he says, "Fantastic night, great. Thank you for everything that you've done. This is a special moment for the club, etc. I just have one last thing to say. Just make sure it's not the last time we're here." And it was one of them moments where you think, you hear about, I remember being with Phil Jackson from the Lakers years ago, and he said to me, "The best thing about winning is not losing." And when you realise at the top of these clubs, whether it's the top of Premier League football or Champions League, you know, the NFL, etc., the drive at these top clubs is when you win, it just usually brings relief. And that's tiring after a while, because you think, I want to be a part of something where I actually enjoy it and not feel relieved.
So immediately after winning, so what you're saying, and we can broaden this out to successful coaches and teams, and we'll get to the ones you've worked with in the U.S. as well, but the mindset, and maybe it's universal in sport, maybe it's Serena Williams and Lewis Hamilton as well, where you won and immediately your priority is to win again, because you're scared of then losing after winning. Does that make sense? Is that the mentality these people have?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's you asked me a question before about the transition of a club like Bolton to Chelsea. So you know, at Bolton, you know, you every five games you'd sit the players in the dressing room and say, you know, you give them a dressing down. Hey, listen, guys, you know, you're getting sloppy. You're turning up late for practice. You know, you're doing this. You know, and it was all about sort of behavior based around winning. That you realize that the product in a club like that is you have to stay on top of it all the time to get the most out of it. And then after about 3 or 4 months in Chelsea, one of the directors said to me, you know, what's the difference between what you've experienced in 8 years at Bolton and what you've seen Chelsea to start with? And I was like, we never talk about the things about, you know, personal motivation, drive, energy. It's just there. Like at this level, it's just there. And, you know, there's a great saying, you know, your job at the very top is not to motivate the talent, it's to not demotivate them. So that's part of it. It's like, how do we create an environment where they can aspire to be? And if they're co-creators of that experience with it. And, you know, when I look back at my career, some of the mindset I enjoy today came from them experiences. Frank Lampard, Michael Ballack, Didier Drogba, Peter Cech, who just had this constant drive to win it. And there's four trophies every year, and they might win two of them, but they'll remember the two they lost. So I think it's a DNA thing.
Do you think they've got that in them? It's not some, if you don't have that in you, and yeah, at some point when you get to a certain great level, you can think, yeah, of course I want to win. It's good to win, but you might have not that in you, as in like the hatred of losing, for example, like some of the great guys you mentioned. You think they really had them in them since a very young age?
Yeah, I think there's ones where, and you can see them percolate up at different times of year. I remember Yuri Djorkaeff saying to me, like, cup finals are the opening of champions. And it was like, you live for them moments. And, you know, there's moments where you drop off for him, but you're here for their moments. And there's an intensity that comes with him. So is it a DNA thing? There's people smarter than me who've researched this. Do I think it's inherent in a lot of them? Yes. But do I think the environment, which is what we're really talking about here, can enforce that or can demotivate them? Absolutely. And I think when you're running a top club in any major sport, your job is not to demotivate the talent by creating an environment for them to achieve. And people often say, oh, you know, the when you're at the top with the best players in any major sport, it must be really difficult, big egos, etc. The very, very top talent, in my experience of NFL, NBA, so they're really easy to deal with as long as you're putting the right challenge in front of them. It's the pretenders at the level below that cause the biggest problems. Yeah. The ones that are occasionally turning up and delivering something great, but have no consistency, no personal drive, they're your problematic talent.
You've spent so many words about great players and people and stuff like that. What struck me is, after you left Chelsea and other people in the industry, when they describe one of your strengths to me, and you can tell me if you agree with this, is you're really good at putting systems and processes into place that lead to better outcome. I know it sounds like management speak, but they said, like, you know, he's the org guy, you know, among other things, right? And it strikes me that you move on and you have Michael Emanalo, Marina, and for a while, and Chelsea keep winning. And Chelsea keep winning titles. I mean, I think after you left, Chelsea won another two or three titles. They obviously won the Champions League. Other than the year that Jose came back and they were on their way to relegation, you know, you didn't have too many disasters. I'm not saying you need to take credit for stuff that came way after you, but when you look at how Chelsea operated after you left, did you feel like, okay, some of those things are the systems that we built together and they're still using them?
Well, I think I can't really answer entirely for that. But what I will lend to, I think when you know, going through that era of change, so if you look at Jose Mourinho and his first tenure at Chelsea after Ranieri left and he came in after winning at Porto, you know, there was that period of stability, and then there was a period of great instability from a head coach as a data point of head coaches. And when there's instability, you have to try and put it in. I remember going to the board and saying, it was like, I mean, two or three coaches in, and I said, you know, this is fine now if we keep changing coaches, but at some point we have to decide our DNA as a business. We, you know, we're not infinite anymore. The investment's here. We've got an opportunity. Selfishly, it was always my challenge was, you know, when you change a coach, comes with three assistants, then you got, you know, change five other people, then he doesn't like the medical director, then he doesn't like the head of scouting and all that. So selfishly, I was then trying to find 10 or 12 other people every time there was a change. So, you know, what we decided, and I think it was actually after Carlo Ancelotti won the title in that first year, did the double actually with that older group of players. It was like, why don't we try and capture and codify who we are? Okay, what's our DNA? You know, and everyone says it's a Manchester United way or a Chelsea way, but it's like, what is that operating model? So if we were sold tomorrow, ironically, several years later, and someone came in and said, like, what is the blueprint for success here? How does this system work? And we spent a year basically codifying what it was across all the areas. And there's some tremendous talent in there, Neil Bath at the academy level, some very, very good operating people, heads of department. But it allowed the club to take a step back and say, this is how we function as a business in this next era of growth. And I think one of the biggest things was the empowerment of the support staff to support whoever the coach was. Okay. I think if you go back 10 years ago, the average tenure of a coach, and then you go to now in the Premier League, it's halved. If you go to any of the major sports in, you know, even the revered sports like the NFL, the NBA, etc., all of them sports now, the average tenure is less than 3 years for a head coach. All right. So Chelsea were probably at the start of that revolution of instability being actually the operational norm. So some of them practices I think were continued, but I also think just the business as usual in the Premier League, as one proxy, meant that you had to continue to build a business of which the coach was a part of it.
Before we move maybe away from Chelsea, just one on Mourinho, because he's a fascinating character, I think, for a lot of us who know him a little bit, know him a lot, know him very, very well. So not as well as you do. What was your relationship with Jose? Because I think maybe of all the managers that you've worked with you or who you hired, he must have been maybe the most, fascinating might be the word, or challenging maybe, or something. What kind of relationship, and what can you tell us about Mourinho as a manager when you're his boss, technically, really?
The Chelsea of today, there's a huge part of that legacy that belongs to him, and rightly so. I think when he came back the second time, which was towards the end of my tenure too, I think he was the right coach at the right time. I know the year three phenomenon that gets well documented, but you know what he did in them first 2 years to bring stability back to the club, to bring a sense of direction, you know, to give a stability also to the fan base, that was exceptional in that, really. So I think he deserves a huge part of in the history of the Roman Abramovich era, but also the modern Chelsea. But, you know, he was incredible when he came into the Premier League. You know, I remember being in many games against him, and no coach knew how to play against him. No coach knew how to do it. And he transformed preparation, attention to detail across the league, and that probably had not been seen since Arsene Wenger first came into the league. So he deserves a huge credit in the history of Chelsea for me.
So what gets me here in talking to Mike, Jules, is you know you can do it. You've had this really successful run at Chelsea, obviously before that Bolton and whatnot. But where your way of working has generally worked, right? And it's shown that, yes, the manager is super important at the club, culture, whatever, but the club is more important. Because whatever else people think about, you know, the Roman Abramovich era at Chelsea, they had a lot of money, but they also had a lot of managers who came and went, and they still won. So clearly it was the framework. What I find interesting is he knew that it worked in football, but can you translate that way of working, can you translate that core into a different sport and even to a different country? And I think that's what pushed him to move to the U.S., to start his company, Sportsology, and to become a consultant for different clubs. And already, I think, his rep had grown to the point that one of the very first clubs to hire him was a club which at the time in the NBA, and you're a big NBA fan, was pretty much the gold standard for how you should organize your club. And that club was
the San Antonio Spurs. And you think, like, well, really, they don't really need anybody else to tell them how to do things, considering how successful they've been.
But I think very successful people always say, and I'm going to sound like Mike Ford here, but they have a growth mindset, and they say, I can always learn more.
Exactly.
And even learn something from this strange little man with a strange northern accent.
You mentioned San Antonio Spurs. RC Buford was a general manager, president of the Spurs, been there for a long time, been a co-partner of Greg Popovich, who obviously is a legendary coach in the world of basketball, as equivalent to, for me, Sir Alex Ferguson, Belichick in that. And actually, RC and I had got to know each other over the years, partly down to me traveling, him traveling. We were kindred spirits in the, you know, sharing ideas, you know, where do we get the next thing? Hey, I'm rebuilding the medical team. How should we do it? I'm rebuilding the scouting team. So we had this sort of cross-pollination of ideas way before we actually started working with him. So I put him as a real sort of instigator of changing that. And when I left Chelsea, he called me 3 days later and he said, listen, where are you now? I said, oh, I'm still in London. He said, would you come out to Las Vegas? And I was like, for what? Like a party or whatever? He said, no, it's the NBA Summer League. And he said, I'd just love to sort of spitball some ideas. So I fly out. And in that journey, they had just been beaten game 5, I think it was, or 6, I can't remember, by the LeBron James Miami Heat. And the way he talked about it was like, you know, we're going to go through change and we've got to do this. I'm thinking, dude, like, you've just been beaten the final. Like, what's the problem, you know? You've had 20 years of 50-plus wins, which is a gold standard in the NBA. And it was a great sign of someone who was agitated to learn and grow. Back to that curiosity thing, Gabs. Yeah. So he asked me and then subsequently the business to do the following, which is to help him, you know, project a future. You know, there were some things in European sport that the American sports hadn't quite picked up. You know, a lot of stuff around medical performance, the use of play development, etc. That, you know, we have academies in European football from how do you develop young players and how do you bring them through a system. So I wasn't teaching him anything about winning. I wasn't teaching him anything about the NBA, but it was just a sounding board for new ideas. And there was also a possibility that Greg Popovich was going to leave at some point, you know, which 9 years later, he's still there doing a phenomenal job. So succession planning was also on the agenda and that. And then from that sort of first tenure, this is the beauty of the North American market. I was based in New York, and we're 100% referral, you know, recommended us to two other teams. They did us. One of them was actually the Philadelphia Eagles. Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman had asked us to sort of do an organizational audit, bring us look at best practices. Howie actually came through me. He's just been sadly beat in the Super Bowl a few weeks ago, came with me to Europe.
We don't need to mention that.
Okay. And, but so we were seen as a independent voice that was across a number of different sort of sports with best and next practice ideas. And, you know, the American market is always looking for the next and best idea. Yeah. And it's an outsourcing market by nature.
So I want to kind of go to the core of this, because that's one of the things that I find most interesting, right? So the NFL has 32 teams. You've got the NBA, you know, all roughly around the same amount. These are all people who know each other. It is the NBA slightly less so, and maybe the NHL slightly less so because they have European players. But these are closed systems, right? Nobody's going to develop, you know, some new play or some new way of evaluating American football players in Korea that's going to become relevant in the NFL. And so that's what I find really interesting is, you know, if you're not winning, right, you can either do what everybody else does and do it better, or you can do things differently. But I kind of find in American sports, there's a disincentive to that, because you could add a third thing. You've got a salary cap, you got the draft, you just wait a few years, things are cyclical, and there's a good chance you'll be better, and then your fan base won't, you know, will be okay, and they'll still fill your stadium, you'll still make money. Am I being is this an accurate picture of American sports, where it really takes an outlier to go and do things differently because there's disincentives to that? Am I being unfair here on American sports, I guess is what I'm driving at?
No, it's a very different market. After spending nearly a decade in the US and being entrenched in all the major sports there, it is a different market. You know, it's a capitalist market with a socialist sports model at the heart of it, what it is, which is, you know, if you are, it was very binary at one point. Now they're changing it, you know, particularly things like the NBA, the worst team got the best pick. Now it's a lottery for the, you know, the bottom four or five teams and that. So they are changing, they're stopping people from tanking, quote unquote, which is, you probably followed in some of the sports and that, particularly the NBA.
I'm a Sixers fan. What can I say? I'm well familiar.
Okay, so you live through the process. So I think it's a very different model to the US and that. But within that closed league and set of practices, there's still inefficiencies, right? So this is the thing that keeps us all up at night is, and why, you know, I know we'll get onto it, about new owners or new entry owners into the cap table of teams will believe that they can arbitrage value, is that they believe that, you know, there's inefficiency in decision making, there's inefficiency in selection, there's inefficiency in game management, there's inefficiency in healthcare, there's inefficiency in play development. And even in a closed skill sport or a closed league sport like the NFL, et cetera, the NBA, there's opportunities to create arbitrage and value, because you're right, you can end up in the first or second draft pick. Again, it's market forces. Do you punt your pick to some a year down the line when you think you need it? But you've still got to get the most out of the talent. Now, the NBA is, I think it's, if you have two all-star players, it's like, you know, a 75% chance of, you know, making a conference final and that. So the talent is heavily indexed. So how do you get the best talent? Whereas sports like the NFL, you see the turnaround, the rebound of a 3-13, I know it's a 17-game season now, into a 13-3 season. Take Doug Peterson. You're in Philadelphia. We were part of that search process after Chip Kelly. So within years, they're in a Super Bowl. And so there's certain sports that lend themselves to the mechanical shift than other ones.
You knew sports, U.S. sports, a bit, but as you said, you went there before even moving over there. But did you realize then that football, and we heard Todd Boehly and Ekbali, for example, when they bought Chelsea, saying there's a lot of things that European football or European soccer could learn from US sports. Did you realize that as well 10 years ago when you first went there, as different as the two worlds are, in a way, there's both things that they can learn from each other. Like, they hired you because they wanted to learn what you could bring from European football to US sports. Did you also see some things that they were doing so well in the US that could easily be imported in European football?
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's a great point. And I think the guys are right. If you've lived across different sports, you see different points of maturity of different practices. So I would say in European, in the American sports, and particularly the close closed leagues like the NFL. It's the NBA, obviously, is more of a global platform now. NHL, obviously, in Northern Europe has a presence in that. But a lot of the practices were held within the league. Now, you do have it in the NFL, and, you know, we mentioned a couple of people, the influence of the college game on the NFL, which is now becoming prevalent. Now, you know, for every Pete Carroll, that transition from USC to win the Super Bowl with Seattle, there's one or two other coaches who don't make it. But the practices within the US, I found, were, you know, very, very professional and very, very dedicated, but no one had really horizon scanned what else is going on. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they kind of know about some certain things, but they're solving the problem through their own ecosystem when there was an opportunity to look outside. And that's on the field and off the field. So probably what you referenced with the new Chelsea owners was more indexed towards new commercial opportunities, more fan engagement, fan experiences, etc. And I think that's absolutely right. You know, that's the panacea for all of these clubs, and we'll probably talk about it later, the American owners in this case coming into the market and saying, you know, if I own the Brooklyn Nets, and I'm just using them because it came to mind, and I want to take my team to play in Paris, it's not my decision, it's the NBA's decision, right? And I come as a package with that. But if I'm Manchester United and I want to take my team to Indonesia or to the US, it's my decision. And that free market was part of the, if you've been an American sports owner living through that other model, and I won't reference what I think of it, but if you come into this new market, it's an amazing opportunity. And I think Manchester United have been a poster child of that, good and bad, over the last 10 years.
All right. I think this is a pretty solid transition, because Jules mentioned Boley and Iqbali before, and, you know, some of the things that they've said about they're 20 years behind, blah, blah, blah. Heard Gary Cook back in the day said some of the same things. So obviously was an American, but had worked in the U.S. My reaction was, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, I kind of gave Boley and Iqbali a hard time, because I said, hang on a minute. You're talking about bringing these innovations from American sports. You're saying they're 20 years behind. But we've had American sports owners in the Premier League. Kroenke, the Glazers, the guys at Liverpool. We've had these guys for 15 years. For 10, 15 years. So presumably, if there were these brilliant innovations and inefficiencies to exploit, those guys with their U.S. major sports expertise would have found them. But maybe not. I mean, was my initial gut assessment wrong on this one? Are there still more to be found? Because these owners have been here a long time.
Yeah, I think there is. I think if you track two different stories. One is the Manchester United story of commercial growth, and one of Liverpool's sporting performance. They're two that both of them come, I think, have got footprints of Americans' ways of working. All right. So the think about this as an entertainment asset, and how do we sweat the asset, which is probably the Manchester United paradigm. And then the paradigm of the Red Sox, who are an incredibly successful team. And bringing that, you know, through Michael Edwards and his group of people into the team, and how did they drive performance? That was in a very American, for me, business plan. So I would sort of push back a little bit that they brought practice in that have brought commercial and sporting success into two big teams. The question is what's the next paradigm? All right, where is the paradigm shift again? And again, I'm not 100% sure. We know there's gold in them hills. Well, we don't know whether we got the tools yet to find him.
So basically, we're talking, Jules, nearly a decade in the States, where, you know, he's worked with dozens and dozens of franchises.
Yeah, different
in different sports.
Yeah, exactly.
From MLS to the NFL, Atlanta Falcons, the NBA, yeah. Major League Baseball, the NHL. But you can tell, right? You can tell from his accent.
Yeah.
The guy is a Manc.
Yeah.
He's a Manc boy who goes around the world and he wants to come back, right? He's been in basically these foreign countries we call the United States and West London, Chelsea, different environment.
Yeah.
He wants to go home. And he knows he has a skill set of understanding not just the two different business models, but at a time when the Premier League now has, I think it's, you know, more than half the owners are American, or people who've done a lot of business in the US or that skill set, I think, becomes more valuable.
Definitely. And also, when you've been moving from one organization to another, because that's what you do as a consultant, you maybe stay 6 months, maybe a year maximum, but you don't really feel that you're fully part of the franchise or the organization because you've just arrived to do a job that they've asked you to do. Maybe you want to be more settled, and maybe you want to have more responsibilities and staying for longer to build something or go and get more successes.
And that's why you went flat out and you asked him.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question. I think everything's for certain times in your life. And that, you know, I had a wonderful experience and, you know, two projects in the Premier League, and that. And then, you know, evolves. It's back to curiosity. You know, I had a curiosity and an interest about the global landscape of sport. Okay, you know, how do you get success in the NFL? How do you get NBA? What are the differences? What are the similarities in that, really? And, you know, with the greatest respect, inside a club every day, there's a little bit of stairway to heaven. Okay, here's another transfer window. Here's another coach. We're going to bring him up, and then he's going to, you know, down. Here's a set of players. So, like, there's a time and a space for it. And my time and space has gone for that. What I'm really curious now is the next level of how do you build organizations, both from a operational footprint, but also the use of capital to grow the opportunities to the next level. Again, that's personally what we as a business, you know, 40% of our business is now engaged with the institutional capital and private equity firms who are curious about how they help teams, franchises, leagues, new leagues create value as the market changes.
You're obviously from the north of England. First of all, I'm assuming you were a football fan when you were a kid. Were you actually a supporter of a club, and do you still see yourself that way today, or is this impossible because you have to work for many different clubs?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I am obviously for Manchester, a great giveaway. Grew up as a Manchester United fan. I always say there was no Man City back then. So I didn't really have much choice. As it pertains to now, I'm very agnostic in that, you know, we move a lot across a number of sports and other teams, and I'm in pursuit of the people who want to get better, and I've become a fan of them projects, to be honest with you. Whether they're a client of ours or not, or the people who have got in pursuit of something that's great, they're the ones that I sort of gravitate towards now. But I think, you know, as you start to have children and they ask you what team you support, I think then it's going to get a bit more live, right?
but it's relevant because so this is my thing in general with globalization of sports and how people become fans and whatever. I mean, Jules, you're from Paris. Yeah. You're a Paris Saint-Germain fan. Yeah. Also, because you and the club are roughly the same age with PSG's long history. But when you were a kid, Manchester United were not good. When you were a kid, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, this is pre-Fergie, right? This is... All right, they weren't getting relegated like in the 70s, but this was a club which had a lot of fans, big history, blah, blah, blah. And so today you get the sense that, especially as the game globalizes around the world, people become fans of the clubs who they see on television and who they see winning, right? A lot of people my age outside England are Liverpool fans because they remember Liverpool winning European Cups in the 80s. And that next generation now, and in the 90s, they remember great United teams. What I'm driving at is you became a United fan when United were not good. I mean, they're still big, but not good, right? How important is that? How important is winning to attracting fans, or if not winning, giving the appearance of success, or in terms of serving your fans, keeping them happy, keeping them coming back? Is there another way to make fans feel like they're part of something, feel like they want to love their team, spend money on their team, follow their team from Indonesia or Paraguay or wherever, and be a part of it without winning every year?
Yeah, listen, I think winning solves a lot of problems commercially, brand wise, etc. But there's only one team who can win every year, right? In every major league, and so it's like, how close are you to winning? And how compelling is your story? I think that was the history of it. I think one of the things that, you know, I've seen and been in North America on a day-to-day basis is giving me this exposure. There's now a new set of fans coming through that, hey, I live in New York, but I'm a Lamar Jackson fan, right? So I don't really follow a team. I actually follow a player. You know, the NBA's probably got that sort of generation. And I think whether it crosses over to the European market, but I think the next generation of fans, they'll follow players more than they'll follow clubs, which is a challenge for the clubs, because how do you manage both worlds? Okay, how do you manage the aura of association that's created with a 100-year brand like Manchester United or a Real Madrid and that, and marry that with a young individual who's, we're all living in the attention economy. There's so many things that pull us on in different directions. Like, how do I create the aura of association around my franchise? It's probably trying to marry the star player with the franchise. And if I'm not winning, then maybe they'll follow the star player to the next club. Like, I think this is a new challenge that we certainly see with some of our clients as they think about the evolution and the new commercial opportunities. It's like, how do you manage them two things together? But with success, you know, keeps Pandora's box shut in pretty much every industry, and certainly in sport and certainly in football.
Mike, while we were preparing for the show, I read a few things, and you were involved somehow in the Erik ten Hag arrival to Manchester United?
Yeah, listen, I won't go out of respect to the clients, and I wouldn't go into the detail of it. But let's just start with where any club should be as they think about the future. You know, one of the two things in my experience of hiring leadership people, and you can put a coach into that experience, and that is, you know, taking the time to understand like the mistakes you've made, understanding the opportunities that sit in front of you, and how do you thread the needle on what's required for the future? You know, so you referenced coaches before. I remember being in the process to hire Carlo Ancelotti. The average age of the team, I think at the time, was 29.5. They were built to finish, as they'd say in the NFL, Gabs. Mm-hmm. This was a roster that was built to finish. And he was the guy who was the average age of the AC Milan team was 31, right? And they would always sort of be there, competitive in the top four, but also certainly in the quarterfinals plus of the Champions League. And so solving the problem via your hires is obviously the goal. The other thing that people invariably miss out on and underestimate is market forces. At the end of the day, Liverpool ended up with a coach with Jurgen Klopp because he leaves in April, Borussia Dortmund, pretty unexpected, one could argue. He becomes available. He sits out the summer. Brendan Rodgers leaves his position in the October, and there's a very small market of potential people who could do that job. Great for Liverpool to do it. I think Manchester United were in the same age. Sometimes market forces and availability or lack of availability speaks to it. But I give Manchester United tremendous credit for taking the time from an ownership and a board level down to decide the direction that they wanted to go, and then be brave enough to take that decision. Because it's easy to do the work, it's harder to make the decision.
When you were mentioning how you hire or when you fire a coach, whatever, I think those super talented players that you mentioned, the one who have that winning mentality in them, they found you out if you're not at the right level as a coach. And, you know, I was a really good footballer when I was a kid. I was not good enough to make it at the top. But if I go and take this United team or the City team for training one day, and I've prepared my stress session, I go in, after 2 seconds, they say, who is this clown? Because they would know instantly that I'm not good enough for them. And I think for me, the danger when you must hire a coach, whoever you are, whatever level you are, is that if the guy is not good enough, your players, especially the main one or the leaders in that dressing room, will see it straight away and they find you out. And then it's over before you even finished.
You're always trying to solve for the quality of the group and the moment the group of players are in. I think that's the same in any major sport. But, you know, I used to, every transfer window when I was involved in a team in a day, I'd find the top five or six players and I would say to him, you know, collectively, individually, you know, we're going to go into the market. We're not talking about players. We're not talking about positions. But give me the top 3 to 5 characteristics. If you see a new player walk into that dressing room, locker room, whatever the term is, like, what do you want out of them players for you to feel like this is a project that's going forward? This is a club that's going forward. And they would talk through it. Now, that becomes then your glasses in the opticians of lens that you sharpen. So when we go to a player in Italy or in France or Spain, and you're carrying the top six players with you, because what you're trying to do is make them top six players, seven players, and not seven top players, eight players and that. So understanding kind of where the culture of the business is now and then picking for that solution, I think is really important. But to your point, you know, Arsene Wenger used to say this, all top players want to see other top players come into the team so long as it's not in their position, yeah. Right? And I think there's always room at the top for a lot of quality as long as it's planned effectively. All top players want to see other top players play with them.
And what would those players say to you when you ask them what character do you want to see coming through the door in the summer? Would it be like, I want an arrogant guy, and someone would say, I want a chill guy? Was it as specific as that? Or they want winners, they want this, they want pedigrees, they want, what would they say?
Yeah, I think if you've got the spine of your team that's consistent and they've lived through it, you know, one of the great traits of successful teams like Golden State Warriors, they keep the jazz band together. And therefore, they're living through experiences, right? So they might win a title, they might go a game seven and lose the title the following year. But they're aggregating these set of experience. They're your best barometer, in my experience, because they're telling you, hey, we fell at this final hurdle. What was the thing that was missing? And it might be just consistency. It might be a mentality thing. It might be a character thing. You just never know what they're going to do. The key is not to lead them into it. Hey, I think we need players with higher character. Yeah, I agree with you. You never really know, right? But I think it's in making players, and certainly the top players, feel a part of the co-creation of the culture is critical for success. And then as a management team, along with a coach and the ownership, is your job to solve the problem. Because back to what we talked about earlier, at the top, they come motivated. Our job is not to demotivate them. How do I demotivate them? One of the levers is bringing in players who have not necessarily less ability, but less mentality. And therefore, you force the top players to feel that this is not going forward anymore. And all of a sudden, in times lastly, on times of change, in times of trouble, it's never your second-tier talent that leave first. It's your top-tier talent. And you see that in sports like the NBA, where the player power now is huge, where if they don't feel like the team and the franchise wants to win, where they got 2, 3, 4, 5 years left on the deal, they're coming in and saying, I want to move. So your job is, how do I keep this jazz band together of the top talent and add to it strategically as we go forward?
So it's interesting, and this is a final point for me. What you mentioned there, and I think you mentioned Arsene Wenger before. Years ago, when I wrote my book with Gianluca Vialli, Wenger explained that when he arrived at Arsenal, he saw all these older players, most of them British or Irish, and it's obviously Adams and Keown and Winterburn and whatever. And he said, oh my God, all these veteran players, nobody knows who I am. How do I get them over on side? I've talked to David Dean. I can't just sell them all, get rid of them, and bring in a bunch of guys I like. I have to win them over. And one of the levers he pulled was, he essentially says he pulled two levers. He said one is he looked to see how much money they made, and he saw that compared to what players on the continent, players elsewhere were going, these guys, because many of them had been at the club for so long, they were really underpaid. And he said, look, I will get you, I'll reward you, I'll get you all new contracts. And if you follow me, I'm also going to show you how to be good professionals and how you can continue your career into your mid-30s, which I think, other than Adams, they pretty much all did. And it's that kind of thinking, I think, that you're talking about there, Mike, right? So finding the lever with, when you arrive in, you need to win them over, you need to get buy-in from the players. And what the lever to pull at one club or in one team situation might not be the lever to pull at a different team situation.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great story. That, you know, the best coaches are the ones, you know, you mentioned Carlo Ancelotti before. They've got the ability and the confidence to suspend judgment about the way they think the world should be and meet the problem where it is or meet the opportunity where there is. Whether it's, I remember Carlo telling me about when he was at Juventus and he had Baggio, Roberto Baggio, and he was saying, like, listen, the problem, I came from a Rigo Sacchi mentality that this is the only way to play. And then I have Baggio, and because I've got a certain fixed mindset back to mentality, I can't get him to play in this certain way. And he leaves, right? And he said it was a lesson for me. Like, you've got top talent. It's your job as a coach to work it out, not their job. It's your job, right? So this, whatever that lever is, you know, whether it's a system style of play. I remember Carlo telling me about, you know, we wrote this in the book together that we did with a guy, Chris Brady, who's a super talented guy. And he talked about the system with the Christmas tree. And he sort of talked about, you know, Pirlo being moving positions and Seedorf and Rui Costa and Kaká. And he got them in the room. He said, like, there's four of you here. You're all world-class players, but there's only three positions. Like, you kind of work it out, right? And it's that confidence as a coach to suspend your own judgment, to be not in a fixed mindset, to go forward with it and find the solution. And I think, you know, that the coaches that have longevity and sustained success are the ones that are comfortable with themselves, and they've got enough EQ, like you talked about Arsene Wenger, to find the thing that's important for them to drive the lever of change.
Is Carlo Ancelotti the nicest guy in football?
I've seen him get mad, very mad.
I'm sure.
I think, just to use Carlo, you know, Carlo is I think the sport of football in Europe won't appreciate what he's did and who he is until he's left. But I would say, you know, he's a tremendous ambassador for the sport, never mind the club he works with.
Well. Yeah, I agree.
But we're massive fans.
We are big fans.
You're not going to get an argument from us there. And on the EQ piece that you just mentioned and the meeting somebody where they are, I know you need to respect your client vis-a-vis Ten Hag, but I'll just speak for myself here. I did not think he was going to do so well because I saw him as somebody who was rigid, who succeeded in a certain environment, playing a certain way at Ajax. And yet, where he had a whole structure of strong people around him and whatever, and I didn't think he had that at United. And yet, what we've seen, he's been a very good man manager. He's made very difficult decisions, brave decisions, witness Cristiano. I think he's certainly tweaked the way he plays on the field relative to the way they played at Ajax. And I think this speaks to some of those values about meeting the team where they are that you spoke about earlier, Mike. So there, I said it, not you.
I agree.
Thank you.
Jules, I thought it was a different conversation. That's what we try to bring you.
Definitely.
With the Gab and Jules Meets podcast. Somebody who really is under the skin, who's making those big decisions that ultimately are kind of what drives the narrative. And
yeah.
I felt like I learned a lot also about the eternal kind of compare and contrast US sports versus European
Definitely.
Sports.
Fascinating conversation, really. And again, we talked a lot about managers, players, sometimes a bit of sporting directors, only in some countries more than others, but rarely about people like him, like Mike Ford, who is a huge part of the success or not of your club. And I think to have his insight on the game and on sports in general, both in Europe and in the US, was really fascinating.
So for more conversations like that, of course, among the ones we've done in the past, some guy named Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Victor Montagliani, who was the first one, the CONCACAF president, big job, by the way, being 2026 World Cup. We've had Sammy Khedira,
Branchini,
the super agent Giovanni Branchini.
Yeah.
I think there's lots of good content, and a lot of it is evergreen content. So if you like this one, go back and check out the other ones. And thank you for spending your time with us.
Real quick, what's the easiest choice you can make? Window seat over middle? Taco Tuesday over salad? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/gabjules.